Welcome, excellent friends, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find me sailing east, absolutely certain that I'm going to find something completely undiscovered by man or beast. And oh, what's that coming over the hills? It looks like a man with his head in his chest, but it's not. It's my co-host, Barry McStay, just looking slightly hunched after 5 months of lockdown. Hello there, you strange anthropophagi.
Have we hit France yet?
No, not yet.
This is a fun episode of the Third Foot that we're going to be doing.
As I'm sure you're well aware, listeners, this is your bonus episode where each month we pick a previous winner or interesting beast from another episode and drill down into it to find more depths of idiocy and heroic failure. But this month's is a little bit different. Very recently, you'll remember we did an episode on the world's worst monument with Athena Kublenyu, and the winner was yours, I think, which was the monument
at the centre of the world.
in Croatia, which very much is not the centre of the world. Is it the centre of the world or the centre of the universe?
Centre of the world. Oh, but hang on, maybe it is the centre of the universe. There might be a cartographer on Mars who's done the concentric circles thing, but even further out beyond the... Maybe the spiral arm of the Milky Way is part of this concentric circles monument, and this thing is so much bigger than we originally thought.
Oh man, literally wheels within wheels. Yeah. I mean, the cartographer of Mars is a rock opera written by Rick Wakeman that no one needs to hear. But about a week or so after it, we got a contact from a chap from Norway called Petter Vegsund Brodin. Hello, Petter. And I'm going to read to you some of his messages to us. He said, I just listened to today's episode, and I think I have a monument that has your selected winner beat, as it perfectly embodies the overlapping criteria of being somewhere totally insignificant and being rooted in dubious scholarship. And can I just say, listeners, I very much enjoy Petter's collaborative and competitive spirit. So here's what he said. Let me set the stage for you. We're in the village of Hien in Norway. It is a tiny, picturesque place in Western Norway with about 600 inhabitants and is part of a municipality that has less than 6,000 inhabitants spread across an area about 60% the size of Greater London. And can I just say early doors, strong cartography game there, Petter. Yeah. Real strong. So, I'm sure from having seen the image and the name of this episode, you'll guess where this is going. But just in case you haven't, the village's claim to fame is it is the place in Norway that produces the most catamaran ferries. However, that's not what... However, as you might expect from a small town who maybe wants a greater identity... Things got a bit out of hand about 30 years ago, because 30 years ago, a chap who, in Petter's description, had probably eaten way too many fermented potatoes or rancid cod, published a book titled Christopher Columbus, en Europea fra Norge, which translates to Christopher Columbus, a European from Norway.
And they're so resolute about not going into the EU up there, aren't they?
Christopher Columbus, a Norwegian who is part of the European coal and steel community, and only that. In it, this chap argues, based on extremely dubious evidence, that Columbus was actually born in Hien, lived there until his teens, and then moved to southern Europe. Now, we're going to talk about that theory in more detail in a moment, but when the people of Hien heard about this, they decided to dedicate a small park to Columbus with not one, but two monuments. The first one is a stone with the name Columbus written above it with a silhouette of the man himself. And it is really underwhelming. It just looks like a very lazily made lithograph. The second one, which I'm going to take us down a fun little B road on, first of all, is an oval rock resting on top of another rock, referencing the story of the Egg of Columbus.
The what?
The Egg of Columbus.
A rock opera written by Rick Wakeman.
Yeah.
Egg of Columbus.
Now, I'd never heard of this before, but apparently it's a real sort of literary trope that has persisted throughout the centuries. So you've not heard of this at all?
Even a literary man such as myself has not heard of the Egg of Columbus.
It refers to a brilliant idea or discovery that seems simple or easy after the fact of discovery. And it refers to an apocryphal story in which it's said that Columbus, having been told about that finding a new trade route was inevitable and no great accomplishment, challenges his critics to make an egg stand on its tip. So basically they're saying, oh yeah, finding a new trade route is easy. And he goes, really? Let's see if you can do this apparently impossible but easy thing.
That's not comparable at all.
No, it's not comparable at all. Apocryphal, Barry. Apocryphal.
Columbus sounds like a real dick.
I mean, yes, he is.
I feel like I've encapsulated 2020 right there.
Yeah, I don't think his rather obtuse response to his critics based upon eggs is the real pinnacle of Columbus's dickishness.
Yeah.
I think there are many tens of thousands of dead people in the Caribbean who would have a lot more to say about it, but they wouldn't because they're dead. I mean, they'd be dead anyway by now, but they were dead in rather less pleasant circumstances.
Particularly if they ate his eggs, which have probably gone off by now.
Yeah, I imagine so. No, the Chinese, when they were sailing around the world, nicked them first. That is such an appalling mess of the linearity of history. Anyway, Columbus, dinner table, eggs. Columbus proved his critics wrong by simply tapping the end of the egg to flatten its tip and laying it down on the flattened tip. So it's a real sort of Edward de Bono lateral thinking response.
Yeah, but it's not comparable to sailing to find a new world.
No, it's not. But the notion is that, finding a new trade route is so easy. And Columbus's response is, well, only if you think laterally.
laterally being west.
Yeah. Yes, but Columbus very much thinks laterally east.
Yeah. But then, surely, hopefully, the people he was being a dick to with this egg went, ah, yes, but, and they build a lasso, fling it over the horizon, and drag a country into the coast of Spain, and go, aha, easy.
And they made that lasso out of sausages, because this philosophical debate very much took place over a fry-up.
Yeah.
So, basically, the term has gone on to be used as sort of a catch-all name for various kinds of tangram puzzles and also several mechanical puzzles. And it's all related to this notion of anything can be done by anyone with the right set of skills, but not everyone knows how to do it, is what Columbus's egg encapsulates. Like, can you make an egg stand on its tip? No, I've got no idea. Ah, but if you just know the knack of it, suddenly you can. Can you discover a brand new, hitherto unknown continent? Well, no. But if you've got the knack of it by sailing in completely the wrong direction, then perhaps you can.
He's like one of those people who's like, you know what? If you just want something enough, it can be yours.
You're saying that the Egg of Columbus is the Renaissance version of the Notebook?
Yeah.
But here's the brilliant thing. Columbus's egg turns up in the writings of some enormous heavy hitters. So, in the introduction to the third edition of Frankenstein, Mary Shelley references it by saying, in all matters of discovery and invention, even of those that appertain to the imagination, we are continually reminded of the story of Columbus and his egg. Invention consists in the capacity of seizing on the capabilities of a subject and in the power of moulding and fashioning ideas suggested to it. Leo Tolstoy mentions Columbus's egg in War and Peace when his character Helene explains to his spiritual guide her reasoning as to why she's not bound by her previous vows of marriage to Pierre after switching religions. Helene says, the spiritual guide was astonished at this solution, which had all the simplicity of Columbus's egg.
Right.
Nikola Tesla also referenced it. He put on a display in 1893 at the Chicago's World Columbian Exposition, celebrating the 400th anniversary of Columbus's arrival in the New World. And he used the story in an Egg of Columbus exhibit that had a rotating magnetic field in an alternating current induction motor, and it spun a large copper egg until it stood on its end. which is a very Elon Musk thing to do, isn't it? To go, actually, Christopher, you didn't need to tap the pointy end of the egg. You just need to use some incredibly esoteric science.
I bet Tesla got a really good grant from the university to do that.
Yeah. Even such a great historical luminary as Adolf Hitler has used the metaphor of Columbus's egg in Mein Kampf.
Right.
Writing in Mein Kampf, he says, examples of the Columbus egg lie around us in hundreds of thousands, but observers like Columbus are rare. And let's be fair, if you'd said to me Adolf Hitler was inspired by Christopher Columbus, I would have thought it would have been the horrifying genocide rather than the apocryphal egg story. But there we are.
It was to put the word order on the end of the sentence, New World.
Yeah. And since another listener who got in touch recently, Jenny D'Souza, who spoke to us about patents, there are currently at least 18 United States patents for Columbus egg puzzles, starting in 1891. So we might have a little further look into that. But Jenny or any other listeners, if you fancy using a patent and creating an egg for us, or perhaps
no, I just want an actual egg and a spoon. That's what the Columbus message tells us.
Oh god, like Columbus on school sports day, I imagine would have been tedious.
Christopher, it has to be, you know, on the roly side. You can't just flatten the egg and make it easier to balance. Also, you can't get a Labrador and lop its leg off and enter it into the three-legged race.
Thank you very much for ticking the box of cruelty to dogs. I didn't know how you were going to get it in, but you did it beautifully. So let's go through this this theory about why Christopher Columbus, Genoan who worked for the Spanish, was actually Norwegian.
Yeah.
So the Norwegians who wrote it were called Svein Grodis and Tor Bok Sannes.
This is this book from 30 years ago.
Yeah, this is the book from 1991. And what Sannes says is that Columbus's son, Ferdinand, who is also his biographer, claimed that their surname, Colonus, which means farmer, was a translation of a foreign name. Now, the Norwegian theorist, Sannes, says that if Columbus were of Scandinavian descent, then Colonus would be derived from the surname Bonde, as in the house, says here in my notes, is in the House of Bonde, which gets very close to the house of something else entirely. Turns out also Columbus very much into BDSM, which again the inhabitants of the Caribbean would agree with, sadly. Now this is where it gets very tenuous. He points out that the coat of arms of Columbus and the royal coat of arms of the House of Bonder are very similar and use quite similar iconography. If you actually look at them, really don't. More specifically, Sannes claims that Johannes Colon,
who's the grandfather of Christopher Columbus, was actually Johannes Bonder, the grandson of Tord Bonder, and thus a first cousin of King Charles VIII of Sweden, who was also Charles I of Norway.
Got it. Also, yeah. The idea that the coat of arms look very similar, and therefore they must be from Norway, is like the Irish flag and the Ivory Coast flag are just the reverse of each other, so clearly Ireland and the Ivory Coast is the same country.
So clearly Didier Drogba is actually Tony Cascarino in disguise.
Yes. They both still have an English granny.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, if Jack Charlton, God rest his soul, could find a way to get Didier Drogba to play for Ireland, he would have done it.
Yeah, if anyone could have, Jack could have.
Yeah. Two of Columbus's father's neighbours had the name Bondi, and Columbus also had close acquaintances called Galli, almost the name of another important Norwegian noble family. I love that the word almost there is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
Yes.
And for all sorts of fun here, on top of this, you have another surname related to it, which is Scotto, which Sannes speculates could be of Scottish Norwegian descent. So there is another theory that Columbus might be Scottish.
I've just had a quick Wikipedia look. There is an article about the Christopher Columbus origin, which has a lot of countries claiming Columbus being from there.
Don't worry, we're getting to that.
Oh, really? I'm waiting for the article that claims that Columbus was American and he was there the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, Columbus is actually 600 years old and was there when Leif Erikson turned up. Yeah. He was like, no, turn around. This is not for you, mate.
Yeah.
Bonda also claims that Columbus made a journey in 1477 and discovered the Americas then, specifically Devon Island, which is an island sort of in between Iceland and Canada. Other bits of evidence Stannis claims is that Columbus never wrote in Italian. That doesn't really make him stand out in that era. Consistently called himself a foreigner in southern Europe and has been described in some biographies as tall, fair, and blue-eyed.
There were Normans in Italy.
Yeah.
It's not inconceivable he could be that. And yeah, he would call himself a foreigner because he was Italian in Spain.
He's made the same sort of leap that people take one look at the pyramids and go, clearly aliens.
Yeah.
When, as we all know, the pyramids were actually built by a time-travelling Christopher Columbus. My favourite quote from Stannis is him saying, "I believe what I wrote. There is nothing in history to show he was not born in Norway."
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the whole absence of proof isn't a proof of absence. There's no proof, Ben, that you didn't discover America.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. I can add that to my CV.
Also, I'm just imagining Christopher Columbus trying to balance a pyramid on its tip. But please go on.
I should point out some of the inaccuracies in this theory, even more inaccuracies. Petter's girlfriend has described them as saying even more tenuous than the coats of arms used to explain that Shakespeare was actually someone else. So this is the Norwegian equivalent of Francis Bacon was actually Ralph Fiennes. Other errors in this book about Shakespeare being Norwegian, there are word etymologies that are simply made up. Claims that the coat of arms share diagonal bars are nonsense because literally thousands of unrelated coats of arms have the same features. It appears to invent a Norwegian king from around 115 BC, and it takes a king's great uncle and turns him into a king's cousin. So what essentially we're saying is this scholarship is bobbins, but we're not here for highfalutin scholarship on this podcast. We're here for wonderfully concocted bobbins.
I feel like they did a little bit of that screenwriting trope where they wrote the ending first. Columbus is Norwegian. Now let's work backwards and figure out how.
Yep, that sounds about right. But obviously, Barry, Columbus wasn't Norwegian. Clearly, as we all know, Columbus was Jewish.
Yeah.
So, but not just any type of Jew. He was a Catalan Jew. Now, spoiler alert, guys, being Jewish in Spain in the late 15th century was not a great place to be Jewish. I mean, obviously, you can just fill that into any algorithm for any country in the history of Europe, but...
And he still won't get into Durham University.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if you're a Jewish student trying to get in, you get two A's and an I. At that time in Spain, the Spanish Inquisition were very much in favour of persuading Jewish people to convert to Christianity or die. Many of them took the route to becoming what was known as conversos. Some of them became known as Muranos, which literally means swine in Spanish. And the Muranos were Jews who basically said, sure, we'll convert, but practice Judaism in secret. And in the end, in 1492, the year that Hitler sailed the ocean blue, oh dear.
We've really just, you know, thrown history into a blender in this show, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. We're making a delicious fascist smoothie right now. In 1492, as well as being the year that Columbus sailed the ocean blue, that was also the year that the Muranos were chucked out of Spain, and many of them ran away to Holland. And it's a reasonable assumption to say that my family, the Vandervelds, could well have been Muranos, could well have run away from Spain to hide in Holland.
In the continuing game of hide and seek between the Jews and the Inquisition.
Between the Jews and all of humanity.
Yeah.
That is lovely. Don't say Jewish diaspora, say global game of hide and seek.
Yeah. Israel's just a game of sardines that's gotten out of hand.
Please, gefilte fish. What are Israelis, Jews, but 4 million roll mops all huddled together? So the theory put forward that Columbus was a Catalan Jew was put forward partly by Simon Wiesenthal, who was a famous Nazi hunter, and an academic called Estelle Irizarry. Wiesenthal postulated Columbus was a Spanish Jew, and he argued that Columbus's concept of sailing west to reach the Indies was not inspired by geographical theories of the day, but actually in his faith in certain biblical texts, particularly in the book of Isaiah. These quotes, like many Old Testament quotes, are a tenuous foundation for this theory. It says in there, "Surely the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring thy sons from far, their silver and their gold with them." That's very much, I think, filling in the blanks afterwards. And then also from Isaiah, "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth." Tenuous.
Yeah.
Irizarry has got slightly more interesting theories, also backed up by other scholars such as Jose Arugo, Celso García de la Riega, Otero Sánchez, and Nicolás Díaz Pérez. They think that Columbus was one of these Muranos, one of these Jews hiding their background. So in his will, he made five provisions, two of them that do sort of stand out as being quite Jewish. One is that one-tenth of his income should go to the poor, and this tithe is known as tzedakah. Any Muslim listeners will know it as zakat, which is very similar. Give a tenth of your earnings to the poor. And also, he wanted to provide an anonymous dowry for poor girls, which is another Jewish custom. He also decreed that money should be given to a Jewish man who lived at the entrance of the Lisbon Jewish quarter. Also on these documents, Columbus used a triangular signature of dots and letters that resemble inscriptions found on gravestones of Jewish cemeteries in Spain. And the theory is that when a Jewish person dies, there's a particular prayer you say over them per year called the Kaddish, and that the sort of abbreviation for the Kaddish is this sign and is often found on Jewish gravestones. And this sort of anagram has been used in various places by Columbus.
Okay. So this, if not Jewish, influenced by Judaism.
Yes, there's more. It's bollocks, but there's more.
I like that they've gone, just because he was nice to a Jewish man in Lisbon, he clearly must be Jewish, because everyone who wasn't Jewish was being a prick to us back then.
Well, you know, Columbus had to be nice to someone.
Yeah.
There's also, this I think is not very strong evidence at all, but the money he was given for his expedition was apparently not directly from Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, but via the Treasury of Aragon. And the Treasurer of Aragon was Louis de Santangel, a famous Jewish converso. And Gabriel Sanchez also helped, and he was also Jewish too. There was also another loan for it given by Don Isaac Abrabanel, who was a rabbi and a Jewish statesman. And the first two chaps I spoke about, Santangel and Gabriel Sanchez, they were the first two people who Columbus wrote back to. Now, for me, that doesn't prove he's Jewish. That just proves he knows what side his bread is buttered on. Sorry, his challah is buttered on.
Yeah.
And he needs to make sure that his financiers know that the money has been well spent.
Yeah, exactly.
Two last little things is that at the top corner of 13 letters that Columbus has written, there is a little handwritten Hebrew sign, the Bet He, which is two letters Bet, which is the Hebrew equivalent of B, and He, the equivalent of H. And it means Be'ezrat Hashem, with God's help. And observant Jews for centuries customarily added this blessing to their letters. No letters to any outsiders bear this mark. And the one letter to his son Diego, in which this was admitted, was the one meant for King Ferdinand. So the theory is that he's trying to hide his Jewish identity.
Okay.
And the very final one, and again, this is tenuous, but may have some foundation, is that Columbus was originally going to sail on August the 2nd, 1492. However, August the 2nd is the Jewish holiday of Tisha B'Av, which is a fast day which commemorates the destruction of the two temples. And obviously, that would be an inappropriate day for a nice Jewish boy like Columbus to sail. You and me don't necessarily know what the weather was like on August the 2nd.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the reason. Coincidentally, the day that he set forth was the very day by law that Jews were given the final choice of convert or die.
Hmm.
I would find it much more plausible that Columbus was Jewish if he had had a hold full of Jews going off to discover the new world and, I imagine, populate the Catskills.
Yeah.
But of course, Barry, we all know that Christopher Columbus wasn't a Catalan Jew. He was Portuguese. In 1988, Jose Mascarenhas Barreto wrote a book, and it claimed that Columbus, and this is a great story, was Portuguese and was a spy who hatched an elaborate diversion to keep the Spanish from the lucrative trade routes opening up around Africa to the Indies.
Look over there, a different continent.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's it. The first time a continent has been used as a decoy.
Yeah. Like a magician throwing Australia on the floor and disappearing in a puff of smoke.
Yeah, it's incredible. What's that you're palming? That looks awfully like Haiti. No, yeah. No, nothing up here. My sleeve's here. Now, Barreto claimed through studies of, again, historical documents and, bizarrely, his interpretation of the Kabbalah, that Columbus was born in Cuba, Portugal. He's the son of a Portuguese nobleman, and that he concealed his real name. So Columbus was a pseudonym, and his real name was actually Salvador Fernandez Zarco, son of Dom Fernando, Duke of Beja Alentejo. Proponents of this idea have got found documents where supposedly Columbus refers to Portugal as his homeland, states his nationality as Portuguese. These are thin on the ground.
Right.
And don't have much basis at all. But again, as we all know, he wasn't actually Portuguese, Barry. Columbus was actually Polish.
Yeah.
Writing in the Polish Review, someone called Krystyna Lukasiewicz commented on rumours that in 1444, King Vladislav III of Poland, he didn't die, no. He hid on the island of Madeira, which, as we all know, very accessible from Poland. And
convenient hiding place.
A very convenient hiding place. So the notion is that Columbus was actually the son of Vladislav III, who grew up in Madeira under the name Enrico Alemão, and similar to the Portuguese hypothesis, used the name Christopher Columbus, which literally translates as the bearer of Christ and the Holy Spirit. So it does sort of work as a pseudonym that would gain favour in Christian courts.
Yeah.
And then, you know, went and did what he did for the greatness of the local court.
But he wasn't Polish, Ben, was he? He was somewhere else. I feel
no, he was from Genoa. Literally, yeah. Every single academic worth their salt says this is clearly the case.
I like what Ireland did, is that we didn't claim Columbus. We just had our own monk who went to America instead in the form of Brendan the Navigator.
Yes.
Not only is Columbus not Irish, but we have a monk like 800 years early getting there.
Is Brendan the Navigator meant to have got there before Leif Erikson?
Yeah, I think he's one of the earliest ones that's meant to have gotten there. He's pre-Viking. Meant to have gotten there in a curragh, which is a open fishing boat. And Tim Severin, the modern adventurer, replicated the journey in the 70s.
Did he manage it?
Yeah, they got to Newfoundland, I think.
Oh, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And so I like the thing with Brendan the Navigator is I like that he's called Brendan the Navigator, not Brendan the Intrepid Sailor.
Yeah.
I get the feeling of just this Irish monk in a boat going, it's round here somewhere, I swear it.
Oh, I thought you meant like someone else is doing the steering, but he's beside him going, two clicks left,
yeah,
and hard right.
Well, like he's giving him his pace notes, like he's rallying.
Yeah, exactly. Being the navigator.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
One last thing before we wrap up, just as me and Petter were finishing our conversation, he just dropped in just going, if you think this is nuts, just wait until you find out about the theory of a guy who thought that Atlantis was actually Swedish. So.
Oh, God.
And we are going to have to do a full episode on Atlantis sometime.
Yeah.
But let me introduce you to Olaus Rudbeck, also known as Olaf Rudbeck the Elder. As is the tradition with a lot of the people who appear on this podcast from the Age of Enlightenment, a wonderful polymath. He was a scientist, a writer, professor of medicine at Uppsala University with the great title of Rector Magnificus.
I mean, Rector Magnificus of Uppsala is definitely the finest title known to man.
It is. I mean, the way you just said it sounds like it's straight out of a Carry On film, isn't
yeah.
it?
Uppsala.
He focused on human anatomy, music, botany. He also sort of laid the foundation for a lot of the work of Linnaeus. However, right. one of the things he's most famous for is a 3,000-page treatise over four volumes in Swedish known as Atlant eller Mannheim, or translated into Latin as Atlantica. And he wrote it in two columns, one Swedish, one Latin. And in it, he claimed that Atlantis was Swedish, Sweden was the cradle of civilization, and the Swedish language was the original language of Adam in the Garden of Eden, from which Latin and Hebrew evolved.
Okay.
Now, at the time, his contemporaries understandably went, "You're absolutely bats, mate.
Yeah.
This is nonsense." The physician Andreas Kemper and Danish professor Ludvig Holberg went as far as writing satires based on his writings, which is some real academic shade being thrown there.
That is amazing. Way back when we did the World's Worst Conspiracy Theory, we also talked about the idea that Finland doesn't exist. So we've basically done the entire Scandinavian peninsula.
Yeah, pretty much. All we just got to find out is whether Denmark has got anything going on.
Denmark is actually Danish bacon. The entire country is just bacon.
It's just a sliver of bacon.
Yeah.
Yeah, it works for me.
Why do you think Hamlet was from there, Ben?
Glorious. Absolutely glorious. I am dabbing as we speak in celebration at that. But, and I love these connections. I say connections, or maybe it's just proof that toffs only breed within their own class. But Rudbeck is an ancestor of one Ludwig Nobel, the founder of Brand Nobel, and Alfred Nobel. So there's a direct line from a man who thinks that Atlantis was Swedish to the creator of the Nobel Prize.
That is amazing. And Nobel was involved in the manufacture of TNT, so maybe that was how Atlantis got destroyed. It was an early experiment in dynamite.
Maybe. And here's the very interesting thing, is that in 2011, I believe it was, divers off the coast of Sweden found a sunken village in the Baltic Sea that dated back to being 11,000 years old. There was wooden implements there and sharpened antlers used for either decorative purpose or sport. There was a build-up arena that might have either been a lagoon or a harbour, bone pieces. So they were very quick to say, this is not Rudbeck's Atlantis. This is just a sunken Swedish village. Because, you know, a lot can happen in 11,000 years.
A lot, yeah, there's a lot of sunken towns and villages along coastal Europe. There's like, and every time one of them gets discovered, there'll be an article in like the Eye or the Daily Express going, archaeologists find, inverted commas, the real Atlantis.
And academics quickly reply with, no, they didn't.
Yeah. Hang on, Ben. What if Christopher Columbus was Atlantean?
Of course, that makes perfect sense, because the main place that Atlantis is believed to be is in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, so the discovery of America is much easier.
He was just trying to go home. It was like E.T.
What, like E.T.?
Christopher Columbus, phone home.
Well, he couldn't phone home unless he was also Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah. In 1492 as well, Columbus turned into Alexander Graham Bell. That's how the rhyme goes, right?
Well, listen, if it's got a pleasing couplet, then it is definitely a historical truth.
Yeah.
So there we have it, friends. This should be a great inspiration to any of you. If you hear anything that we've talked about and think you either have a better suggestion that we've missed or it inspires you to lob a fact our way, please do it. And who knows, we might turn it into a special Third Foot episode. You can contact us on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter on @worstfoot, or send us a wee message like Petter did via our Facebook page, Worst Foot Forward. I'm on Twitter on @BenVanderveld, and he is on Twitter on @BazMcStay. Thanks as ever to all of our lovely Patreon supporters who give us the money and support so that we can find the time to do just this. As you'll know, we recently hit the goal of 50 patrons, which meant that me and Barry have been working away on our book. At the moment, we're at the collating stage of just gathering together all of the brilliant stories that we want to put in the book and working out how to put it together.
It's been really nice doing it, going back and discovering things that I'd completely forgotten we talked about. I've got the document up in front of me and just looking at the thing here. In 2015, the Oxford English Dictionary Word of the Year was an emoji. Yeah, it was the face with tears of joy of laughter one.
That's the worst one.
And in the same episode of these are from World's Worst Word, we discovered the Irish word trumpador, which means trumpeter, but can also be used to mean a loud-mouthed, brash moron.
Ah, oh, perfect. So once we've collated a few of them, we're going to put together a couple of trial chapters and an intro. But we are very much in the collating stage. So if there is a particular story that you really love, please do get in contact with us about that. And also, we are just 8 patrons away from hitting our next goal. When we hit 60 patrons, we're going to make a special Worst Foot Forward treasure hunt episode that you can play along with at home, featuring some of the oddest trivia we've discovered. So since, you know, going out is still not hugely recommended or safe, if you want to have a fun night in with perhaps some of your pals hunting for odds and sods from the weirder corners of history, and you haven't donated to us yet, head to patreon.com/worstfootforward, where you can donate from as little as $2 a month. And when 8 more of you do it, we're going to do a special episode for you.
Good. News to me. Oh, please, please keep those coming in. And we've had some nice people sending us stuff by email as well, pictures and memes and weird cushions and things that they've seen in their local shops and stuff. So whenever you see weird and stupid stuff in your locality, it's nice to know that people immediately think of Ben and myself.
Yeah, I'm delighted that the pair of us are essentially your sinkhole for the weird and arcane marginalia of life.
Yeah, that's bad enough, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. Right, where we'll all off to get in a bathtub and head due south to find Atlantis 2. That's enough nonsense for now. Until next time, friends. Goodbye.
Bye.